At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and home of the Duff McKagan joke of the week. Here we go.
Yes, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan here, still dealing with that laryngitis from the spider bite in Zurich, Switzerland. Not joking. I got to tell you, this nun, she was taking a bath, and there was a knock on her door. It was a nun, you know. She's like, oh, who's there? And the answer was, it's the blind man. And she's like, oh, he's blind. Poor shepherd, you know. Well, come on in. And a guy comes in. He goes, hey, nice tits. Where do you want me to hang the blinds? Thank you very much.
Oh, my gosh. That's great. Not much else to say about that one. Duff going a little blue there, but thanks to Duff for delivering the jokes week in and week out, no matter what he has going on in the world, including laryngitis from a spider bite or a Guns N' Roses tour. How about the fact they played Locomotive the other night in Wichita for the first time in like 27 years, one of my favorite Guns N' Roses songs. GNR is in Austin tonight, Friday, October 11th, for Austin City Limits Festival, and then they're headed to Tennessee on Sunday to play the Exit 111 Festival. Get tickets to any of the upcoming dates at gunsandroses.com and go check out Duff. Ask him to tell you some jokes because he's very good at it. So speaking of good, Brian Alvarez is always very good on the Wrestling Observer Live, Wrestling Observer Radio on WrestlingObserver.com. And he returns to Talk as Jericho today to talk about the 100 things WWE fans should know and do before they die. His new book, and he's going to tell us about some of the things that made his list of 100 things and how hard it was to come up with the list in the first place. We're going to talk about some of the obvious stuff like WrestleMania, Monday Night Wars, Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan. We'll also get into some more controversial list items like Crown Jewel and Chris Benoit. And we'll talk about one of my favorites in the book, the Intercontinental title. And of course, we're going to talk about the state of wrestling today. AEW coming on the scene, how that's changed things for WWE, how it's changed things for the business. Here we go. Brian Alvarez right here now on Talk is Jericho. All right, so here with Brian Alvarez of the Wrestling Observer, also coming on the Jericho Cruise, which is going to be a total blast, man. I'm super excited that you guys are going to be there.
Oh yeah, I'm very excited to go on the cruise. It is coming 3 months after my next child is born, so it literally will be the first time that I leave the house in 3 months for a week on a boat.
Well, I was laughing when you were announcing to Dave who was all going to be on it. Dave basically had no idea, like, that, you know, Flair was going to be there and AEW was going to be there. And it's one of those things, because it happened to me too. You accept the gig and it sounds like fun, whatever. And then, you know, you continue on with your life. And a year later, here comes the cruise. But we had such a blast, man. It's going to be, you're going to really dig it. It's going to be one of those things that you go, holy smokes, man. I'm glad that we really got involved in it.
Yeah, we did a thing on Observer Live, obviously, talking about it as well, which got Mike Sempervivi in trouble, I might add.
Yes, he's always in trouble with me.
Yes, we had a lot of people that had been on the cruise last year, and they said it was so much fun. Like, everybody was so nice. Everybody was great. People had stories about, oh, I was drinking with the Briscoes to like 5 a.m. and all of these crazy stories or whatever. But it should be awesome.
Yeah, it's Semper Vivi, man. He won't leave me alone. I think I blocked him at some point, then I unblocked him, and then I had to block him again. I'm going to try and block him on top of the block just out of principle at this point.
Yes.
Yes. Good old Semper Vive. But anyways, we're here today to talk about your brand new book, and I told you I'm coming into this completely completely a clean slate because I just know the title, which is 100 Things WWE Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die.
Playing Larry King is what you're doing.
Dude, you just nailed it. I've done Larry King a bunch of times. He's one of my favorite guys to do, but he has no idea what you're talking about. Might not even remember exactly who you are when you first come on there. So, but yes, yeah, so of course you are a multi-time published author. You did The Death of WCW, and then there was a newer version of that. So I guess just to go right into it, what made you decide to write this book with this specific topic?
When I finished the second Death of WCW, the expanded version, like I didn't really have any desire to ever do another book again, quite frankly.
But it's hard. It's hard to write a book.
Dude, it is so hard. You know, you've done so many books. But I mean, you're doing books. I mean, I don't want to say that what you did was easy. Obviously, it wasn't. But at least you're doing a book about your own life.
Right.
If you're doing a book about your life, sometimes you can just sit down and write about your life for a long time. I mean, doing a book like The Death of WCW, I mean, there's so much research. There's having to watch Nitros again, for the love of God. I mean, it's when I was done with that book, it was just – when I was done with the first one, I said I'm never going to do this again, ever. Mm-hmm. Like, this thing could sell 5 million copies. I'm not doing another book again. It's just not worth it for my life. So then, like, 10 years later, all this time has passed, and they said, do you want to do the expanded version? And it was like, I got all the stuff that we took out of the first edition, so I may as well just throw that stuff back in and write some new stuff, and it'll be fine. So I finished that one and thought, I'm never going to do another book again. So this was an example of them contacting me and saying, we have this idea for a book. Would you be interested in doing it?
This is your publisher.
Yes, this is Triumph Books, 100 Things. So they do a series, 100 Things That Such and Such Should Know and Do Before They Die. They've got Pearl Jam. They've got sports teams. They've got everything you can think of. Led Zepp, whatever. So they wanted to do a WWE book. And they sent me all of these different books. And I looked at it and I thought, I can do this without killing myself. And I think I can do a good job with it. That's what I thought in my head. Mm-hmm. And so I said, let's do it. And they had like, I don't know, it was 9 months or whatever before it had to be done. Maybe even longer. I think they wanted it out for SummerSlam 2019. And I think they contacted me around SummerSlam 2018. So I had a lot of time. I could pace myself. I could do like one entry every day or whatever and get it done. So I said, let's do it. And it was very hard. But when it was done, I didn't feel like I did after death.
Right. Well, it's one of those things too, like when you actually go into, you know, writing a book, for example, and I think for my first book, the amount of hours you put in combined to the amount of money you make, I think I ended up making like $2.12 an hour to do it. Like the time that you have to put into it is off the charts ridiculous. So for you to do kind of a list book, was it a little bit easier to do it this way, or was it just as hard, or was it more time?
I think it was easier because the first thing they said was just make the list. Like before you do anything, just make the list. Make a hundred things. Mm. So I think I came up with like 105, 110 or so. And I sent it around to a bunch of people and I asked them, is there anything missing? Is there anything that I could combine? What do you think? Blah, blah, blah. We cut it down to 95. And honestly, once you have 95, I mean, as long as you don't wait till the last minute, I mean, you just do one every time you have the opportunity to do one. And the next thing you know, you've got 95. I mean, it's not like easy or anything like that, but at least there's a very specific structure that you can write around. So it ended up being easy in that sense. I just had to make sure, okay, I got, you know, 85 days left and I got 42 more to write or whatever. So I need to make sure that every other day I've got one written. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it was easier, but I mean, obviously, like the hardest part of the book is you got to write 100 entries about 100 people, yourself included, and they've got to be 1,000 words or less. That was something that I didn't really anticipate that ended up being really hard.
So what is 1,000 words? Does that translate to 2 pages or 3 pages?
That's probably about anywhere between 3 and 4 pages.
Gotcha. So just by that alone, you're looking at 300, 400 pages of a book. So what were, like, I guess, what, like, when you're thinking about what kind of subjects do you have to do or know before you die? Like, are you putting in, like, different characters in the business, different historical moments? Where do you kind of start to put that list together from?
Well, the first thing I thought was, I mean, there's no way you're going to come close to 100 things that a WWE fan should do before they die.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that you have to do. Like, going to WrestleMania, attending WrestleMania Live, you've just got to do that if you're a WWE fan. I mean, it's the biggest show of the year. Like, whatever you think of WWE, it's always an awesome time. Sometimes it's a little long, but it's a great time. So
mm-hmm.
you're not going to find 100 things like that. You're going to have maybe 15, 20. So then it was characters, like famous people. And so I went through the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, and I basically said, like, if you're in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, you've got to be in this book. And I went through all of those, and then I went through moments. Like, you need to know about the Montreal Screwjob. You probably should know about the creation of the WWE title. You probably should know whatever, you know, the Vince McMahon-Steve Austin feud and what that meant for wrestling, the Monday Night Wars. I went through all of those, and then, you know, if you go through all of the historical figures, all of the big moments, and all of the things that you should do, I mean, you're actually very close to 100 things right there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty easy to fill up the list. And that's basically it. Like, the most important people, the most important events, and the things that you should do.
So you talk about, let's say, going to WrestleMania. And what was your first WrestleMania that you went to?
I think the first WrestleMania I went to, well, it was the one in Seattle.
Okay.
It was 2002 or whatever it was. And that's the first one I went to because it was here. And then starting in about 2006, with the exception of Orlando the second time, because I was so upset about the first time.
What was the first time?
Oh, dude, there was a WrestleMania in Orlando, whatever year it was, and I couldn't get anywhere. Nobody could get anywhere. It was like every single freeway was shut down.
Oh, wow.
It was so miserable. And I was so mad when it was over. I was like, I will never go to Orlando for WrestleMania again. They ever said, oh, by the time they come back, you're going to go. I didn't go. I will never go back to Orlando again if I can help it. But other than that, I've been every WrestleMania since 2006.
It's funny because I never went to a WrestleMania live. My first live WrestleMania was the first WrestleMania I was ever in, which was 15, maybe 16. It was Anaheim, me and Benoit versus Angle. But the first WrestleMania I ever saw was WrestleMania 2. On closed circuit TV.
Wow.
That archaic thing, right?
Yes.
So I vividly remember going with my friend Gouge, the Gouge, Dan Goujon, and he was so disappointed. He's like, you mean there's not going to be one live wrestling match there? And I'm like, no, it's just like it's all on TV. And it's like, why are we watching it on TV? Because it's WrestleMania. Like, duh. So I saw WrestleMania 2, 4, and 5 on closed circuit. And they never had 3 for some reason, which is really a bummer because that, of course, was the big one with Hogan and Andre.
Yeah.
But that's how I used to watch it back in the day before pay-per-view was on closed circuit.
Yeah, they had closed circuit, and then they moved to pay-per-view, and now we've got the network. And
Let me ask you this from a fan standpoint, and obviously – you know, you're in the industry and you're a wrestler as well. And you report on it. You're one of the premier kind of pundits when it comes to wrestling. But you said your first one was 2003 in Seattle.
Yes.
Were you in the business then? Or were you completely just going as a fan?
Oh, no, I've been wrestling inside a wrestling ring since 98. And we had our own little promotion since probably 94. But prior to 98, I mean, we ran shows at a gymnastics academy on their spring floor. And so we had no ring. And so we didn't know really. I mean, we sort of knew what we were doing, but not really. There were some local guys around here that helped us do stuff. But
right.
I never really count that as like my actual career. I count being in the ring. So I'd been a wrestler for like 5-6 years before I went to that WrestleMania.
So you're kind of going in it as in the biz, but kind of a fan. But just explain it for people who haven't been, just how... I guess how much of an amazing experience it is. It's like going to a Super Bowl, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think one of the things too, I mean, I'm kind of not the best person to explain this because I'm not a fan of sports.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't go to sports events. I don't watch sports on television. I mean, I watch wrestling, and I have so much wrestling that I've always watched that, you know, my spare time is not spent in front of the TV. I don't watch any shows or anything like that. And so to me, like I'd never been to a big football game with my buddies or a baseball game, maybe once or twice or whatever. But I just always gone to wrestling events in these little armories. I mean, a lot of fans nowadays, you can go to a wrestling event like an indie and there's, you know, 1,000 people there or whatever. Like the indies are on fire right now. But I mean, back then, I mean, around, especially around Washington, I mean, you're in a little tiny armory and there's maybe 200 people right there. And it's just this little tiny thing. And every now and then WWE will come to the Key Arena, which, you know, there's maybe, I don't know, 6,000 to 8,000 people in there. So then you go to WrestleMania, and the WrestleMania at Safeco Field, I mean, it's just, you can't even believe how many people are there watching wrestling. This place is packed, and it's just, you can't even believe that this many people are there for a pro wrestling event. And it's all of the biggest matches, all of the biggest stars. I mean, everybody's just there going crazy. I mean, it's really hard to explain. It really is. Like, if you're a sports fan, it's like going to an actual sporting event, but you're watching pro wrestling, which if you don't normally go to WrestleMania, it's almost inconceivable how many people are actually there watching pro wrestling.
Right, right. And just the whole thing with the fan festival and all that sort of stuff, it always amazes me. Like, if you, it's a lot like being a KISS fan or a Star Wars fan. I mean, we just played a couple shows this weekend with Nickelback, super hated, but yet have the biggest fans in the world. Like, if you're not into it, you'll never understand it. But when you go there, then you start getting a sense of like, oh my gosh, there's a whole counterculture here where people live and die about with wrestling. And a lot of people don't even know what it is at this point in time. So I think if you're ever going to see one show as a potential fan, WrestleMania is the one you should go check out.
Well, not only that, you talk about that fan fest. I mean, this was before Access when I went to Seattle. And if you go to WrestleMania like now, I mean, you're going to go there and there's Access, and then there's all of the other shows that piggyback off WrestleMania weekend. And StarCast has started up. Right. And it's crazy when you go to one of these WrestleManias or one of these big events and then go to like a StarCast. There are so many rabid fans, and they're totally different. Like, you go to a WWE Access, and you got a totally different kind of rabid fan than you would get if you went to a StarCast. They're just totally different. Like, the StarCast people, they know all about New Japan. They know all about the guys in AEW. You go to an Access, and nobody has any idea. You could wear a New Japan shirt, and nobody even points it out. It's a totally different – there's two hardcore audiences that are into pro wrestling.
Exactly, exactly. And then, of course, talking about some of the big names that the people will go to see. And you talk about some actual people. Can you even mention, I think you said, yourself included, meeting me. So is there a Chris Jericho entry in this book?
Oh, yes. And in fact, I did yours fairly early. And yours was one of the hardest entries to write. Because the whole thing with the book is, I don't want this book to be something where people open it up and they're like, dude, I could just go to Wikipedia and read what he did in his career. So my whole thing was, in 1,000 words, I need to explain to hardcore and casual fans, because I want hardcore and casual fans to appreciate the book. I got to write this guy's whole career in 1,000 words. I need to put it in context. I need to write about all of the important things. I need to point out what is more important than maybe something else, and I need to do it in 1,000 words. Mm-hmm. So I start writing yours, and I probably wrote like 4,000 words or 5,000 words, and I wasn't even done yet. And it was very early on in the book, and so I was kind of thinking like, God, I gotta cut this down, because if I don't, like, this is going to be, you know, a 700-page book, and it can't be. It's got to be 350 pages, whatever.
Right.
So you had done, I'm not just saying this because I'm on your show, but like, everybody should know this if they followed your career. You have done so many things from the day you broke in all the way up until today, by the way, and you're still doing huge things coming up Saturday. And there's a lot of things. I mean, it's kind of like, what do I take out? What about Chris Jericho's career can I take out of this?
Right.
Like, you don't want to take out stuff from the very beginning. You can't take out anything from Nitro. You can't take out anything from when you first went to WWF. You can't take out anything from when you left and then came back. You can't take anything out from 2008. I mean, it was so hard to do yours because you'd done so many things. Now, thankfully, there were a lot of people that hadn't done so many things, and so it ended up working out just fine. But yours was one of the more challenging entries to put into that book.
And like I said, so you would say, like, it's just kind of fitting into the title, 100 Things to Know and Do. So you need to know Chris Jericho, for example, if you're a WWE fan. Is that kind of the reason why I'm in there?
Yeah, you are one of the most important figures
gotcha.
In WWE history. So if you're a fan, like if you're a new fan and you don't know who Chris Jericho is, like you need to know who he is to be a fan of WWE.
Right, gotcha. So who else falls into that category from actual personalities?
Oh, man, like everybody. I mean, if you're a Observer Hall of Fame or Observer Reader, I mean, anybody in the Hall of Fame is in there. Vince McMahon, Triple H, Steve Austin, Rock, Shawn Michaels. I mean, you and Edge and Christian and, I mean, every big name. I'm not really looking at their Hall of Fame. Like, Coco Beware doesn't have an entry. But, I mean, if you're an important figure, if you're one of the if you were the champion for any length of time, I mean, you're probably going to be in this book. Angle, Benoit, whole nine yards.
So you, by including Benoit in there, how does that kind of – do you talk about him – his performances? Do you talk about the kind of adverse effect he had on the business after the tragedy? How do you, you know, go about talking about him?
Well, that was honestly the hardest one of all of them to write because I was a friend of his and
right.
I knew him, not like you did, obviously, but we talked on the phone all the time.
Really?
And
really?
Oh yeah.
Just about the business or about,
yeah, I knew him from probably around the time of Spring Stampede 1999, I think, which was the show that was here in Tacoma. And I met him there and we talked all the time. And so it's a very personal entry because I knew the Chris Benoit that, like, when I talked to him was just like the nicest wrestler I'd ever talked to. And he was always so polite. And when Eddie Guerrero died, he sent me a chair from the Cow Palace show where Eddie Guerrero won the title. And he sent me this letter. And it was this letter that was just talking about how much Eddie meant to him and all of this stuff. I actually put the letter, I published the letter in the book. Like, I'd never published this anywhere before.
Wow. And
so I wrote, like, I had to write his biography. I had to write, like, about our relationship, and I had to write about what he did, and then I had to write about the aftermath. And when he killed his family, I wrote a full Figure Four Weekly about everything, like our relationship and just everything. And I never, like, I wrote it and I never looked at it. I'd never proofread it. I never read it back. I just stream of consciousness wrote this thing and I published it and I never looked at it again. Because it's just so devastating. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then what I had to do for this entry was I had to go back and read it for the first time. I had to go back and get that letter. And I basically had to relive all of that. And it was brutal. And so there's a full chapter in there that talks about everything. I mean, when they approached me about the book, they said, first question, do you want this to be a book for kids or do you want it to be a book for adults? And I said, well, I want it to be a book for adults. And they were mainly asking about Hulk Hogan because Hulk Hogan had the sex tape. He right. had the whole thing and said, like, are you going to write about this stuff? And I said, I'm going to write about everything. And I'll try to write about it in a way where if you're a 9-year-old, like, you can read this book. Not going to be a lot of profanity. Not going to go into detail about Hogan's sex tape or anything like that. But, like, there was one. So I'm going to write about it. And I was going to write about what happened with Benoit. Mm-hmm. So that was very hard. But it's all in there, everything he did, all the details, his career and everything.
What exactly, I mean, you don't have to say it verbatim, but what was the letter about Eddie, like, talking about?
He just wrote this letter and he talked about how close he was with Eddie and how he could talk to him about anything. And he hoped that his kids could someday have a friend like the friend that he had in Eddie. It's just a very personal letter about how important he was and how devastated he was that he wasn't with us anymore.
It's so strange. I'm saying, like, once again, not that you guys weren't close, like you said, but I found that over the years I've had, there's a few stories like that of people that Chris knew, but maybe not knew super well, that he confided in about very deep stuff. It's almost like he felt more comfortable talking to more acquaintances than to actual super close friends about some of this stuff.
It could have been. I mean, I wasn't super close. It's not like I'm traveling on the road with him or anything.
Right.
Like that,
and that's my point. Not that you weren't close, yeah, but it's a different relationship, right?
Yeah. And he's not the only one that I think probably does that in wrestling. You know, I think that maybe, I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I can understand it kind of being like that. You know, you're, I mean, maybe you don't want to talk about these things with people that you travel with every day. I mean, maybe there's that part of you that's like, you know, wanting to be very masculine or whatever, and not talk about your feelings with other dudes that are in pro wrestling or whatever. And maybe wanting to talk to about with other people. I don't know. It's for some reason, like we always talked about everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting that you're able to kind of to write about that. What else do you have? You mentioned kind of the Hulk Hogan thing. Do you have more controversial type of things? Are you trying to keep it lighter, or like what are some of the other controversies that you talk about that WWE fans have to know about?
Well, I think the most recent one was I had an entry about Crown Jewel of all things.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, who even knows? I mean, it's a book that like it's out. And I mean, I don't want to not sell the book right now, but I mean, there are things in the book that are already outdated because wrestling changes so quickly. I mean, I think in your entry, I wrote about how you just signed with AEW or you just agreed to go to AEW or whatever. And meanwhile, like for all I know, you could be the champion at this point next week. And none of that's in the book, obviously, because the deadline was WrestleMania weekend. But I mean, who knows in 10 years what people are going to think about the Saudi Arabia deal. But I mean, right now, it's a pretty significant deal. I mean, you can look at WWE business and WWE network subscriptions, and there were big drops after they went to Saudi Arabia. And it was a very controversial thing. And it was something that I felt when I wrote the book that, you know, this is a tough period for WWE right now. I mean, they're making more money than they've ever made. They're going to make more money than they've ever made by a wide margin starting in October. But if you look at things like Raw ratings and attendance, I mean, canceling entire house show loops, like canceling five shows, not just one show, like canceling the whole weekend of shows or whatever. I mean, it's a rough time for wrestling operations right now. And that came at a time where they probably don't need more controversy, but they wanted the money and they took the money. And a lot of fans were very upset about it. So that was a controversial thing that I wrote about. And then obviously things like the Montreal screw job, which to this day, I mean, there's still people that think that it was a work. And I mean, honestly, if you weren't following wrestling back then and you look at today, I mean, it seems like there's no way this is real. But it's just that the business has changed. It's totally different now.
Let's go back to the Crown Jewel thing. You said a couple things that like, do you really feel, and I kind of see it. I mean, you can see it that there's a subtle backlash towards WWE for the Saudi Arabia business deal. And the fact they went over there and didn't really give a shit what anybody else thought or what was going on in the world around them.
Well, it's kind of weird because obviously they went over there for the money. And it was really interesting seeing how they promoted it, because they would do all of these commercials for Crown Jewel, but they would never tell you where they were going. It was like this show from an undisclosed location. Like every other pay-per-view deal or whatever, they talk about this or that, but they never mentioned they were going to Saudi Arabia. And then when they were there, when they put like, they always put up the city, state or whatever country, they just wrote they're in Jeddah. Didn't even say Saudi Arabia. So they knew how controversial this was, but at the end of the day, they were making so much money that it was like, we'll accept the backlash. We'll accept if anybody ends up canceling the network because of this, but there's so much money that we can't turn it down. And Dave kind of went through and sort of tracked everything. And I think the number that we came up with was probably about 35,000 people quit the network after the Crown Jewel show. And you don't know if they're going to like come back at WrestleMania. You don't know anything about that stuff. You only can track like what happened at any given time. But I mean, there was definitely a backlash. When they mentioned the word Saudi Arabia, there was very clearly booing, but it's hard to say like how much of a backlash and how permanent that backlash was.
Well, and that's the thing. If let's say 35,000 people left the network forever, and what are they charging a month? $10, right?
Yeah.
So it's $120 a year times 35,000. I mean, it's not going to be $500 million.
No.
So, and that's kind of the way that they operate. Well, you take the good and then take the bad and see where the price tag ends up. So, you know, because you do kind of see that. But I think one thing that WWE has done and always does is like, well, people will bitch and complain, but they're always going to come back. You know, that's kind of the attitude they have. Like, we'll tell you what's good. If you don't like it, we don't care, you know?
Yes.
Right? So.
And the thing, too, that is a little bit different now is what you said has been true forever. But this year, when WWE went up against football and everybody was expecting the bounce back in January, like, they didn't get a big bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
And the WWE network numbers right now, they lost. I mean, they're below where they were last year. So we finally got to the point where there are fans who are leaving and actually not coming back. And it's hard to say, like, why that is and if they'll never come back. But it is different this year. And I think that for a lot of them, I mean, there are now so many alternatives, whether it's New Japan World or AEW is going to be starting on Wednesday, or I mean, there's a million streaming services for indies. And plus, there's so much WWE that if you're watching all of the TV stuff, I mean, do you really need to watch more on the network? But there is, it has become a thing now where they're losing people that are not returning.
Do you mention AEW in it all? Was the company even at the point where you would, I guess it's not a WWE thing, but would you mention the fact that it exists in the book, or was it too early for that?
Well, when I was on Deadline, I needed 5 more entries because I did 95.
Right.
And I told them, when I'm done, like, do everything you do to get this book ready for publication, and then I'll do the last 5. Because God only knows, like, because my Bill Ames, the guys that work with me on the book, I mean, they know wrestling. They're wrestling fans. So Adam Moten is my editor, and he's a fan, I think a subscriber. But I figured, like, they'll know if I forgot something. And I may do the whole thing and then realize, my God, I left out Bruno Sammartino or something totally crazy.
Right.
So on Deadline, I had 5 more to write, and I wrote 4, and I had 1 left. And I thought, even though this is a WWE book, I wasn't going to do this. But the last entry ended up being, it's okay to not watch WWE. There's other stuff out there. And so I did a whole chapter on, these are all of the things that are out there. Like, you're not cheating on your girlfriend. It's okay to watch New Japan World. It's okay. There's this AEW starting up. So I did talk about AEW in the book, but the Deadline was around WrestleMania. So it was very, very early. And there wasn't like a ton that I could write about it, but I did put it in the book.
Well, let's talk about that now. You know, you mentioned the book, but let's talk about how things have changed and you know, getting ready for the so-called Monday Night Wars. How do you think all of this is going to pan out at this point in time?
It is so hard to say, because if you look back at the original Monday Night Wars, I mean, everybody was absolutely wrong about everything when it came to what would happen when Raw and Nitro went head-to-head.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone thought, oh my God, you know, we're going to split that Raw audience, blah, blah, blah. Ended up, a brand new audience showed up and the war was on. And 2019 is a totally different time. And you got to remember, too, in 2010, Impact went head-to-head with Raw.
Right.
And they got slaughtered, absolutely slaughtered. But that's also 9 years ago. And so, I mean, to me, one of the big things is WWE is at a weak point right now in terms of fan engagement. They're at a very, very strong point in terms of like how much money they're making, and they're not going out of business. This is not WCW.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like fan engagement, it's very clear that fans are looking for an alternative. This was not the case in 2010 with Impact. So there's no better time for an AEW to kick up than right now. There's no better time. Fans are dying for something different. Now, what that means in 2019, I mean, you're going on TNT, and there hasn't been wrestling on TNT since 2001. That's a long time ago. It's a new channel, but it's a strong channel. And the one thing that I think is a positive for you guys is that wrestling always does well it just always does well. Like, you can look at the El Rey numbers for Lucha Underground, and the numbers aren't great, but they're great for El Rey.
Gotcha, right.
You can look at the New Japan on Access numbers, and they don't really do ratings, but they're thrilled with how New Japan is doing. You can look at the numbers for Ring of Honor on Sinclair, and if you want to compare them to WWE, they're not very good, but they're good for Sinclair. Mm-hmm. So it would actually be an aberration if you guys went on TNT and didn't do well. I mean, my feeling is it's going to do well on TNT, and USA Network and NXT, I feel like they're going to do well. I don't know who's going to win, but I don't picture this as a situation where both go on these strong networks, USA and TNT, and both do poorly. I think they're going to do well. Now, whether this starts a new boom period, I have absolutely no idea. I know nothing about AEW television. I know a lot about NXT TV, but I know about NXT TV on the network. It's totally different once they go to the USA Network. They're going to be changing things weekly.
Why do you say that?
I mean, there's a few big things. NXT on the network is 1 hour. It's taped in advance, and it's a very basic old school wrestling show. I love it. I love NXT on the network, but you're talking Vince McMahon putting that show on the USA Network, going head to head with AEW for 2 hours live, and he's going to be running from Full Sail. Like, I can't even imagine. You guys, you sold out like the first, what was it, five shows. They're all going to be in these big buildings. It's going to look packed. And his show is going to be in Full Sail in front of 300 people.
Right. I mean,
it's just no way that he's going to stay there. You look at the show, and one of the main reasons that so many guys are over on NXT TV is they do so many squash matches. Like, you think that Vince is going to do squash matches from Full Sail on USA Network head-to-head with AEW? I mean, it's all going to change. The days of, you know, an easy one-hour TV show for 6 weeks building up to TakeOver, you got 2 hours every single week live. The TV is just going to go faster. You're going to burn through the feuds faster. It's impossible for it to be the same.
You know, and once again, I can't say anything because people go either, oh, he's still obsessed with WWE, or he's bitter, or he's saying this or that. But to me, just from an outside standpoint, A, I thought it was very brilliant for Vince to do this in one way, because now, ipso facto, we're kind of in competition with NXT, not with Raw or SmackDown, which, once again, this is not our war. It's the war that WWE created.
Yes.
But B, what makes NXT popular to the fan base that likes them is the fact that, like you said, it's an old school wrestling show in a, you know, looks like it's in a high school auditorium or like the Calgary Pavilion, you know, Stampede Wrestling. There's no way that when we start going toe-to-toe, head-to-head, that, like you said, one building is an arena and one building's in, you know, a television studio like Memphis in 1978, Vince is going to see that automatically and want to change it. And then to be able to fill bigger venues on a regular basis, well, what do you got to do? You need more star power, so he'll put more WWE main roster guys on there, which takes away some of the cool factor of NXT and just kind of makes it into a third brand. Now, A, like you said, that could be a whole new boom, or B, it could take away what makes people enjoy NXT in the first place, and in a lot of ways kind of dilute or even almost ruin that brand.
Yeah. I mean, I love NXT, and the main roster shows can be a drag. And one of the things about NXT is it's so different from the main roster. And the last thing that I, as a fan, want is for NXT to become Raw or SmackDown. That's not what I'm looking for. And I'm not sure that fans are looking for that. I mean, you know, Dave has talked about the possibility of SmackDown going to 3 hours. And as a wrestling fan, you're going to watch 8 hours of main roster television every single week, plus the pay-per-views. I mean, it's so... You're asking so much from a regular fan.
That's right. You're asking a lot from your fans. That's true. And the other thing is, too, it's like, I don't know, and we still don't really know who AEW's fans are, because from the analytics of it, which, of course, Tony Khan is an expert in analytics and the concept of it, I don't think there's a lot of people watching AEW that are also watching WWE pay-per-views, at least from what I've heard. So to go head-to-head or not head-to-head or whatever, I don't think it's really going to affect the audience that's going to watch AEW, because I think there's a very small cross section between AEW fans and WWE fans. I don't know if you know differently.
Well, I mean, I just know that when I go to, I mean, I mentioned earlier today, like go to Access, go to WWE Access, and then go to Starcast and look at the difference in the fans. When I go to these Starcast shows, like we did a couple of panels, and I basically ask the people, like, how many here are here in part because you're unhappy with what WWE is giving you? And like so many hands raised. I mean, there is a, you look at the audience for Raw and SmackDown, like how many millions of people are watching, and it's very clear that they have run off so many fans. And you know, everybody listening to this knows, when you're a wrestling fan, like you're pretty much a wrestling fan for life.
For life, right.
For life. It's just, you love wrestling. And I think that right now the AEW audience is an audience that they had to put up with WWE for years. And just like you said, Vince is going to give you what he wants to give you. And if you don't like it, too bad. And I think that finally a lot of people got sick of that. And now this is an option. This is an opportunity for them to basically say, screw you. Like, we gave you the opportunity for so long. You didn't give us what we wanted. Now there's somebody who is, and we're going to support them with everything we've got.
And like I said, I mean, it could lead to a whole new boom, or it's, you know, whatever it is, it's definitely a very interesting time. But once again, when you're talking about WWE, they're very protective of their brand and of their characters, their intellectual property. I was going to ask you right away, did you ever hear anything from them having a book that says, you know, 100 things WWE fans should do with Becky Lynch on the cover and Stone Cold and Roman and Rock and Cena? Is that like, are you allowed to do that without hearing from them?
I have absolutely no idea. That was all the publishing company. And I mean, given the fact that they've done so many different 100 things, like about everything, I mean, they've gone through this before with, you know, dozens of other subjects. So, I mean, presumably they know what they're doing.
Well, I mean, obviously, like I said, it's you can see it right there with WWE right in the middle and all that sort of stuff. So let's talk a little bit more about the book. You mentioned you wanted to get some of the biggest names. In your opinion, who is the biggest star, I guess, in WWE history, if you had to choose one?
I think the biggest star in WWE history, I think you would have to say Hulk Hogan. Mm-hmm. Just because he is by far the most famous, like, WWF, WWE wrestler that there's ever been. And it's kind of a difficult question because...
It is.
I mean, I say that, but at the same time, like, really the most famous is The Rock. But he's really the most famous because of his movie stuff.
Right. Take that out of the equation.
Yes, take that out of the equation, and it's Hogan. And Hogan was a guy where, like, your grandmother knew who Hulk Hogan was. And your grandmother doesn't necessarily know Stone Cold Steve Austin. If you talk about the most important wrestler in WWE history, I mean, it's probably Steve Austin. Because he is the guy that turned the company around during the Monday Night Wars. And, like, his popularity allowed Vince to go public and become a billionaire and end up where we are today, where they can do everything wrong and it doesn't matter. They're going to profit $300 million in a couple of years. So he is, like, if you're looking purely at business, he's the most important guy. So I guess the top three would be Steve Austin, The Rock, and Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, I got to give you that. And you know, if you have to put a fourth in there, obviously you can go old school and throw Bruno in there. But for the top three, I mean, Hogan still to this day, everyone knows who he is because basically he still looks exactly the same. Like, you could still draw a picture of Hulk Hogan and it's, yes, like drawing a picture of, you know, Gene Simmons as the Demon. Like, oh, I know who that guy is. Yeah. And then also, too, you know, I was there with The Rock and Steve Austin having these two once in a generation performers in the same time frame. It really is something that was such a special time in the business. Because of that.
You're absolutely right, but there is also a third person there, and it's Vince.
Right.
Rock and Austin and Vince, like when I wrote the book, I pretty much wrote exactly what you just said, and that is that it was a little bit different, but you'll never, and I know people say never say never in wrestling, and maybe I'll end up being wrong, but I don't think there's ever going to be a time where you have a Rock an Austin, and a Vince McMahon all at the same time.
Right.
It's like impossible. You know what I'm saying? Like the Steve Austin, Vince McMahon feud, where you had the common man and you had the hated boss. I mean, I can't imagine ever having two guys who could play that role better at the same time. Vince was the greatest heel boss, like in the history of wrestling. They've tried with everybody. Yeah. They've tried every heel GM. They've tried every McMahon. Nobody was better than Vince. Nobody was better than Steve Austin at playing his foil. They were perfect together. And you had The Rock at the same time. Like, it's an impossibility.
You also had the timing of it and the circumstances surrounding it. You had Austin as this heel that was such a cool heel in a time frame. Like, you go to the mid-90s, it was turning. The society was turning. Just because you were a smiley-faced good guy didn't make you a good guy anymore. And I'm not just talking about in wrestling. I'm talking about all aspects of life. Like, the shades of gray Austin kind of being an asshole, but people really responded to that. So he was turned babyface before he was actually even turned babyface, as we saw that at WrestleMania 13, where Bret and Austin basically flip-flopped at the end of that match, which was one of the most genius moments ever. And then throw in the fact that Vince really did screw Bret Hart over, and they took the reality and made a story into it. Vince was not supposed to be a heel in that situation. He turned himself into a heel by being such a jerk with what he did to the beloved Bret Hart and acting like he was in the right.
I just love going back, because I went back with my buddy Vinny and Craig, and we watched all of the Raws and Nitros from the Attitude Era. We're in 2000 now. And going back and watching this stuff, that interview that Vince did after Montreal, the famous Bret Screwed Bret interview.
Right.
And he's such a slimy douchebag. And then you realize, in his mind, that was a babyface promo. He was trying to babyface himself and put Bret over as a heel. But when you watch it, you're like, what a slimy. And of course, you know, he didn't want to turn heel. He ended up having to because people hated him so badly. And it reminds me of that famous CM Punk pipe bomb promo, where, as it turns out, in Vince's mind, Punk was cutting a heel promo. But of course, all the fans saw it as like the babyface promo to end all babyface promos. So Vince is a genius, and he's like the greatest promoter of all time, but he's definitely had some swings and misses that at least back in 1990, you know, 7 and 8, he turned into something.
Well, that's where Vince's genius lies, though. He takes the negative and turns into a positive. It might go completely in against what he wants, but majority of the time, like you said, especially a few years past, he recognized that. You know, I don't forget, he's the one that sent Kurt Angle out there to be the ultimate babyface with the intelligence, integrity, and whatever the other one was. And in the middle of his first match, people turned on him. That was not supposed to happen. His first match, they turned on him so bad that Vince told the ref, tell Kurt to go grab a microphone and cut a heel promo. And Kurt was so damn good in his first match, devoid of any, you know, nervousness or inhibitions, took the microphone and did just that. Like, Vince realized, I thought this guy is an Olympic hero. He's going to be a huge babyface and everyone shit on it. So let's turn it right now.
Yeah, in the middle of a match.
In the middle of a match against Sean Stasiak.
Think about how many times Roman Reigns got booed out of the building and he stuck by his guns.
It's the same thing he did with Cena, though. He was not going to turn Cena heel no matter what. And that's what makes me laugh about the Reigns thing, is it's Cena 2.0. Let's talk about Cena. Where do you rate him as far as, you know, his influence and being like the top guy in the company?
He's way up there. I mean, it's weird because, like, if you look at how Vince ran the company from like 1982 on, I mean, his top guys, I mean, he went through top guys, I don't want to say quickly, but if you look at how long Cena was his top guy compared to everybody else, I mean, Cena was his top guy for like a generation, forever. I mean, Cena managed to become like a big time deal, and nobody has been able to do it since. Like, that's the last big time major face of the company that they've been able to create. And I think they've had a lot of opportunities with other guys that they didn't go with. I mean, he gets fixated on certain guys, and he's like, this is going to be the guy. This is going to be the face of the company, come hell or high water. And, you know, Cena did a great job. And it's funny because everyone hated Cena, and they would always say, oh, my God, if you give somebody else instead of Cena, like, things will be even better, blah, blah. When Cena finally left, like, we found out how valuable John Cena was. He was very, very valuable. It was not what everybody said where, you know, if you get rid of John Cena and push somebody else, I mean, business is going to skyrocket. Cena's the one getting in the way. No, Cena was actually holding it up during that period. And when he left, they fell even further.
I think another reason is because I think John was the last. And you mentioned earlier about, you know, you never say never, but that'd be like saying you're a music guy. Like, there's never going to be another Diamond Album Award given. And that means somebody that sells 10 million records, like, you know, done. Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, and Back in Black, and, you know, some of the Shania Twain records, etc. The business has changed now to where that's literally impossible to do. I think the reason why John was kind of the last of the Mohicans of what you're talking about is they're not pushing a top company carrying babyface anymore. They're pushing the company itself. It's the brand of the WWE that has much more of the spotlight than anybody in the WWE itself.
Yes. And I think that in some ways, that's one of the reasons. I mean, obviously, that is one of the reasons they're having some of the problems they're having today, because it's two things. They're not pushing. They're not being able. They're unable to create a new Steve Austin, Rock, Hulk Hogan, Bruno Sammartino the way that they book their product right now. And they're also, their authority figures, their McMahons, are always heels. And it's almost like, I don't even really know how to explain it, but like, to me, they're telling the fans that, I don't even know how to explain it, but there's something about the McMahons as heels on television that I feel makes people upset about the company as a whole. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It all stems back. It's almost like the lineage of the McMahon family. It's like the Game of Thrones aspect of it, to where just because Vince was the shit heel, you know, and I'm going to ask this question a bit, possibly the greatest heel in WWE history, that everybody who, you know, associated with him has to be a heel as well. I think the time frame of the evil McMahon authority figure has to be done by now. And that's one of the reasons why the product does seem kind of stale, because you just don't need it anymore.
No, and I'm watching Shane McMahon as the top heel on SmackDown. He's 50 years old. Like, I'm watching shows from the year 2000 and the shows from 2019, and he's all over both shows.
Yeah.
It's like, it was 19 years ago. We've got to move on.
Yeah, I agree, and like I said, so who do you think is the I mentioned the most popular star? Who do you think is the biggest heel? And we've talked about Vince, and that could be the answer.
It is Vince
completely.
He's the greatest heel in company history, which is interesting, because you had the greatest heel in company history and like the greatest common man babyface in company history at the same time.
Yeah, well, you know. And that's the once again, the dichotomy of it, too, because even now you're talking about, you know, Stephanie's a heel, but then she'll go, you know, do a function where she's leading the Special Olympics. And I mean, they really have blurred those lines between heel and babyface and this, that, and other thing. But I think Vince never really has. Even when Vince was a baby, like, remember, like, is this one of your things where Vince gave away $1 million a week?
Oh, yeah.
So let's talk about that for a bit. I kind of forgot about that until someone mentioned it very briefly the other day.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few different things around that period, but for a while they were doing the $1 million giveaway. And there was actually, you know who's in the book, believe it or not, as one of the 100 things is, of all people, Donald Trump.
Oh, okay.
Because as crazy as this is, like, whatever you think of Trump as president, let's just forget that for a second. Trump and Vince did a storyline where it led to the Battle of the Billionaires at WrestleMania, and it was, up until that point in time, that match led to the most lucrative WrestleMania of all time, because you had Vince and Trump putting their hair on the line, and people were just fascinated by that match, because, you know, everyone always talked about Trump's hair. And for years, you know, everyone joked about Vince having a toupee or whatever. Right. And for whatever reason, like that was up until The Rock. Think about this. Up until The Rock and John Cena, the biggest WrestleMania ever was built around Vince and Donald Trump. And they did all of those storylines where like Donald Trump bought Raw and he was going to drop money from the ceiling. And like WWE investors actually freaked out because they thought that Trump really bought Raw. And so they had to do a storyline the next week where Vince brought it back. I mean, stories like this are just completely crazy, but they're true. So yeah, I mean, as far as like when you look at the goofy WWF Hall of Fame and some of the wacky people, like they'll put anybody in that Hall of Fame. But I mean, Donald Trump, guys like Donald Trump and Mr. T and Mike Tyson, I mean, they legitimately should be in the WWE Hall of Fame because of the difference they made in business.
Well, yeah, people forget that. Like you said, like you just had a great point. Whether you like the presidential decision or not, the guy is a legit WWE Hall of Famer and deserves to be in there, going all the way back to, you know, him utilizing
four and five
at Trump Towers or whatever, or the Trump,
yep,
you know, Atlantic City.
Yeah.
And so that's the most lucrative WrestleMania in history?
Up until The Rock and John Cena.
Wow.
Which, by the way, when you were talking about Diamond Records, I mean, Rock and John Cena is a record that will never be broken, because after they did, they grossed like, it was about $65 million for each of those WrestleManias.
Wow.
And now that they're on the WWE Network and largely off pay-per-view, you'll never come close to $65 million again.
Do you think it was a mistake to take themselves off pay-per-view like that?
Oh my God, are you kidding me? Absolutely. I mean, you can look at UFC. They started their streaming service and they did not put any of the pay-per-views on that streaming service. It was all secondary events and that sort of thing. And they still sold tons and tons of subscriptions for their streaming service and were still making millions and millions of dollars on pay-per-view. I mean, WWE, this is just my thought. They should have done the WWE Network exactly like they did it, but Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, yeah, SummerSlam, Survivor Series, all of those you can only get on pay-per-view. They would have been rolling in cash. But they were so determined to get huge numbers for this that at first, if you remember, like Vince decided they're all going to be on there except WrestleMania. And so we were expecting like the big announcement of the WWE Network to be that. And then they just announced every single one of them is going to be on the network. And I remember just being flabbergasted that he made that decision. And, you know, at the end of the day, they ended up with 1.5 million subscribers. But you had people thinking 3 million subscribers, 4 million subscribers, like they're going to get millions and millions and it's going to be worth it. They never got that. And they're never going to get that. And they killed their pay-per-view business. And they threw away so much money on pay-per-view. Luckily, they got those TV deals.
Yeah, because like you said, man, I mean, I really felt that there was a mistake with that. But I think they were hoping to get higher, you know, subscription services for the paper, for the network, which is why they included all of those shows. But they've been stalled at 1.5 million for, it seems like, 6 or 7 years now.
Yep, they got to 1.5 million. And I mean, actually, I think they're lower than that now. They've actually lost. I mean, they were pretty much at a level where I thought they would just stay there forever, maybe slowly, you know, add a few thousand here or there, but they've actually dropped a little bit. And like, there's no way they're ever getting to 3 million, certainly not getting to 4 or 5 million like some people had projected at the time. But I mean, just think about one day, like $65 million. And now it's just all on the WWE Network. And keep in mind, WrestleMania season, they give that thing away for free to everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone gets it no matter what. I guess as we wind down here, what's the influence that you have of Roddy Piper in this? Obviously, he'd be included. How do you feel with him?
He's very high. He's one of the greatest heels they ever had that never became like the world champion. Or really, even, I mean, during his big run in the 80s, I mean, he never won anything. He had that one Intercontinental title run in the early 90s, which was very, very short. But I mean, he was a very influential character. You can see Roddy Piper in so many different heels today. He was a very, very smart guy. I mean, it was back during a period where he knew, like, when I feud with Hulk Hogan, if I let this guy beat me, they're going to phase me out and I'm out of here. So he never let Hogan beat him. They did all of these different feuds and DQ finishes and that sort of thing. And he was a big time, huge star and a very important part of the first WrestleMania, very important part of WWF in the mid 80s, very big part of the whole rock and wrestling, all of that. Huge name.
Yeah, I think Piper would be kind of the unsung hero of the expansion of WWE, because you mentioned how important WrestleMania 1 was to the company and how, you know, Vince had mortgaged so much, lots of closed circuit to locations, some were tanking, some were not. And at the very end, it was Piper and his promos that made people buy that show, because yes, it was all about Hogan and Cyndi Lauper, but if it wasn't Piper as that heel to really make people want to see Hogan win, I don't think the show would have done as good as it could have or as it did.
Well, yeah, there's so many things about WrestleMania 1. I mean, if you read the book, the WrestleMania 1 chapter is super interesting. It was a lot of fun to go back and kind of do all of the research. I mean, there's so many people that were so important to that first WrestleMania, like Lou Albano being on an airplane, and he just happened to be sitting next to Cyndi Lauper, and he ends up in her music video, and then she gets involved in WWE, and like Mr. T was one of the biggest TV stars of the early 80s, and getting him involved in WrestleMania and then him getting cold feet and wanting to pull out because he thought they were going to shoot on him. And
crazy, right?
TV, rock and wrestling. And I mean, there's so many things about that first WrestleMania that are just, if this hadn't happened, if that hadn't happened, this coincidence, I mean, who even knows what wrestling would be nowadays if that show would have flopped?
Why did Mr. T want to pull out again?
So he was in the tag match and he played, you know, B.A. Baracus in the A-Team. And people believed in the 80s that he was like the toughest guy in America, even though he was an actor.
Right.
And so he was concerned. He got cold feet thinking, dude, what if they shoot on me basically during this match and beat me, humiliate me or whatever? Like, that's the end of my career. And he got really worried about it and he threatened to pull out. And they ended up talking him into staying and doing the match. But, you know, he was legitimately concerned that, like, my whole career could go up in smoke if one of these wrestlers gets in here and ties me in a knot and pins me or whatever. I mean, that could be the end. So, you know, he got cold feet. And, you know, Paul, originally he was going to get the pin in the match. And then, like, Paul Orndorff was like, I'm not putting over an actor. And they had to change the finish there. I mean, there were a lot of things about that match that were fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, that's the business has changed so much, you know, since those days. And it's so funny to think about how you know, as if anybody, any, you know, would shoot on, like, I don't know, Chris Hemsworth comes on Raw and somebody shoots on him just to prove a point in this day and age. But I guess last question, I mean, this whole book sounds like a lot of fun, and I'm really looking forward to checking it out. But I guess besides the stuff that we've talked about, what's your favorite of the 100 things WWE fans should know or do before they die? Something we haven't talked about yet.
God, my favorite one? I don't even...
Or an interesting one.
Of course, the last question is the one that totally stumps me. I mean, honestly, we did just talk about it, but I really... There were a few entries that I had a lot of fun writing. I had a lot of fun writing about WrestleMania 1. I had a lot of fun writing about the history of the McMahon family. Like, obviously, Vince McMahon Jr. is the most important figure in WWF, WWE history. But he's third generation. So everybody knows, like, you know, third generation promoter, Vince McMahon Sr., et cetera. But I had a chance to really go back and, you know, look at Vince's grandfather and, you know, how the McMahon family came to America and how they first got into boxing and did a little bit of wrestling and then, you know, just kind of looking at the history of Vince McMahon's father as a promoter before the WWF kicked off and, you know, all of the controversy around the various world titles and why they even formed a WWF in the first place. And there's just a lot of fun history in there that I tried to make the book accessible to a casual fan. Like Lance Storm writes the foreword and, you know, he writes that I wish I would have had this book to give to my wife and my kids so they could understand what it is I'm even doing. Like it's a great book. If you don't know anything about wrestling, it'll kind of tell you everything about what WWE is about. But if you're a hardcore fan, like I said, I mean, there, I guarantee there's stuff in there that if you're a hardcore fan, you've never heard before, because I never published the Benoit letter for sure. I mean, that's one of them, but there's a lot of stuff in there that I tried to throw in to kind of give something to everybody. It's not too in depth for a casual fan. I don't think it's too simple for a hardcore fan. I try to really make it a book that everybody that's a WWE fan could read and enjoy. And hopefully people check out the book and think that same thing.
Yeah, just quickly run through the history of the IC title. I just love that story.
Oh, the Intercontinental title, yeah. Where they had an alleged North American champion and they did a supposed tournament in Rio de Janeiro, which never existed, and ended up putting the belt on Pat Patterson. And really, here's another thing about the Intercontinental title that I thought was so interesting. When I was a kid, that belt was the be-all, end-all. And it was for a lot of other fans as well, like the Intercontinental title. Like, that's the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Mr. Perfect, all of these great matches. If you go back and look at the Intercontinental title, like the glory period, it was like a year and a half. And that was the period that it was the most important. Like, people remember the Ricky Steamboat, yeah, Randy Savage match at WrestleMania 3, but that was like one match in the middle of the 80s. Then you had a period from like 1990 to 1992 where like all the best workers had it. And then you had this short period in the 90s where, you know, like, you know, Rock and Triple H were fighting over it in a ladder match. And then it was just like the title changed hands 9,000 times. Like, China's the champion. You're the champion. We're watching the show. I can't even remember who's the champion.
China and I are the co-champions.
Co-champions, all of that. It's like everybody remembers how great the Intercontinental title was, but they're remembering like a 2-year period, yeah, and they've never forgotten it.
Yeah, so yeah, Pat Patterson won it in Rio or something, and they just like showed up one day in Allentown and gave him the belt and say you won this in Rio.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, hey, you're talking to the guy with the most Intercontinental championships ever, so go easy, kid.
That's right. That's right. You've got the record.
Hey, man, once again, great talking to you. And 100 things WWE fans should know and do before they die. And it sounds like you had a lot of fun with it, so I'm looking forward to checking out. And a forward by Lance Storm, always a bonus as well.
That's right. Lance is listed as a co-author on Amazon for the 200 words that he wrote in this book.
So. He's been riding your coattails for the last 10 years anyway, so it's apropos.
That's right.
Thank you, my man. I will talk to you soon. I look forward to listening to you on Wrestling Observer Live today, as I do every day.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
And viva Art Bell.
Oh, the best.
Cheers, man. Thanks.
All right, thanks so much.
All right, thanks to Brian Alvarez. His book, 100 Things WWE Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die, is out now. Get it wherever you buy books and get it signed by Brian tomorrow, Saturday, October 12th, if you live in the Seattle area. Brian is going to be at the Barnes & Noble in Northgate at 2 p.m. signing books. So get yourself a copy and get it signed by Brian now. And listen to him on Wrestling Observer Live, Wrestling Observer Radio, pretty much 7 days a week at WrestlingObserver.com. And go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com if you want to join the waiting list. We are sold out. We've been sold out for about a month now. We set sail on January 20th. If you want to get on the waiting list and come be a part of it with Fozzy, AEW, Ric Flair, go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Sign up for the waiting list now. And if somebody drops out, you too can be on board. Once again, AEW superstars are going to be there. The Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, Cody and Brandi Rhodes, Hangman Page, John Moxley, Luchasaurus, Jungle Boy, Nyla Rose, Penelope Ford, Sammy Guevara, Private Party. It's going to be a rock and roll party for sure. DDP is going to be there, Beyond the Darkness. We're all sold out. Once again, go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Sign up for the waiting list now. All right, have a great weekend. And remember, this Wednesday, we got a tribute to Big Titan, the second Razor Ramon at the WWE. Good friend of mine. I got Don Callis here and Paul Lazenby here, frequent guests of Talk is Jericho, to talk about our late great friend, Big Titan, Big Rick Titan. Razor Rick, good guy, and lots of great memories there. So have a great weekend, and we will see you on Wednesday. Remember, if you live in Seattle, Brian Alvarez will be signing copies of his book on Saturday, October 12th, in the Seattle area. So go check that out, and we will check you out next Wednesday. In the meantime, and in between time, stay cool, stay hard, stay hungry, stay wet, and a big yeah, boy!